Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi there. Welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I'm here to tell you that you can radically and permanently change your relationship to food without ever counting calories, carbs, or fat grams. How? Why? Because it's not what you're eating that's the real problem. It's what's eating at you. I would love for you to join me today. The number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Call in and let me know what's weighing on you. So last week, one of our regular callers, Brian from Chicago, he called to ask how he could support the women in his life who were feeling really triggered by what was going on last week in the Supreme Court hearings in the United States. So I started talking about the idea that controlling food is often a response to feelings of powerlessness in other areas of your life. So it's easier to focus on your intake of food or on your weight than it is to deal with an unpredictable boss, teacher, husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, friend, or with a government that feels erratic, unfair, unpredictable, hypocritical, displaying increasing patriarchal hubris and making you feel an impotent, helpless fury. So the wish to manage a person or situation morphs into a wish to control food. You can't control a person, but you can ostensibly control yourself when it comes to food, turning a relational struggle into an internal conflict. Control is also a way of protecting yourself from feelings of vulnerability. Being vulnerable is experienced as being unprotected from potential or probable emotional pain. So taking control feels active, and it is a solution to the passivity of vulnerability. Remember, vulnerability means that you're feeling susceptible to harm, and that harm could be an emotional attack. It could be anything painful. So that's why it's easier to focus on being in control over food than feeling vulnerable in your life. Hold on, I have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Hi, Dr. Nina. It's Nicole. How are you?
Hi, Nicole. You are becoming another one of our regular callers. Good to hear from you.
Yes, I'm actually really enjoying this. You're like my favorite, and I'm so grateful for the difference that you're making in everyone's lives.
Thank you.
So I have another question today. I know that you kind of started talking about control today.
Yes.
And I live with my sister, and both of us kind of have like our like sensitivities to different foods. Like we try to control the environment. Like I really love peanut butter, and it's hard to be around peanut butter because I just want to eat the whole jar. So like I'll tell her not to bring it in the house, and if she brings it in the house to like hide it. And so I just want to know, like, I guess I like make it forbidden, you know, and then there's things she's sensitive to, and then it makes me want it more. And then if I find it, it's like I want to eat it all. And then if I eat it, I feel so guilty. So I was wondering if you have any advice, like in that respect, and how not to want to control the environment all the time, and how not to make it forbidden. And I know it's like a loaded question, but
oh no, it's a great question because I hear that all the time. I mean, and this, when I talk about the anticipation or the experience of deprivation leads to binging or overeating or focusing on, you know, if you're like, I can't eat peanut butter, then peanut butter is going to be on your mind, right? Like I can't eat that peanut butter. So the idea of not being able to have something just makes you want it more. And so what I tell people is have the peanut butter. And most of the time, people are like, I can't have the peanut butter. I'll eat the whole jar of peanut butter or the whole, you know, thing of ice cream or the whole box of cookies. That's only if you think you can't have it. But if you tell yourself you can have it, then you can decide if you want it and how much you mm-hmm. want to have of it. I have a person in treatment. I'm going to change the details a little bit, but she said that she had this like thing for Taco Bell, some special thing at Taco Bell. And every day she'd be like, I'm not going to have it. And every day she'd go through the drive-thru, eat it, and feel guilty and remorseful and end up going home and binging because she felt so bad. And I said, okay, I want you every day between now and the next time I see you, I want you every day to go to Taco Bell and get that thing you think you're not supposed to have. And she's like, what? You're giving me permission to have that thing? It's unhealthy. It's bad. It has fat grams. It's really bad for me. And I said, yes, I want you to have it. Just have it. You don't have to finish it if you don't want to, but you can, but have it every day. So she came in a week later, and she's like, the first day, I was like, oh, it was so good, and I have permission to have it. And she said, I actually enjoyed it. The second day was like, okay, this is good. The third day, she's like, oh, kind of sick of this, right? Remember before, when she told herself not to have it, she had to have it. Now that she had permission, she was having it less. And by the last day, she was like, oh, I ordered it, but then I had like one bite and that was it. I couldn't have any more. I'm sick of it. So, Nicole, have some peanut butter.
Okay. But I feel like I've done that too, where I'm like, let me just eat it and like get it out of my system and then like say I had it. But then I feel like sometimes, I don't know, those like few days of eating the peanut butter, like.
No, that's, see, you're setting yourself up. When you say, let me get it out of my system, the anticipation of deprivation is just delayed. You're not saying, I can have peanut butter every day of my life if I want and I will choose to or not. And until, you know, the end of time. You're not saying that. You're like, I'm going to have it now so that later I won't want it.
Got it. Okay, cool. And then thank you so much. And then you also like talked a little bit about overeating and binging. And I was just wondering like what the difference is between those two things, overeating and binge eating.
That's a great question. So overeating means eating to excess, which is different from binging. So there are lots of reasons people overeat that have nothing to do with emotions or conflicts. Like we Americans overeat on Thanksgiving traditionally, right? That has to do with just culturally we set ourselves up for overeating. Also, if you don't eat enough during the day where you get to the point where you're absolutely ravenous and starving, you may not be able to stop once you start and end up overeating. So that's like a physiological cause for overeating. Mm. So it's really just about food, right? Overeating is only about food. Binge eating is different. Binge eating is a way of coping with something psychological through eating. So whatever that psychological piece is, it's the root of the behavior. It could be emotional, it could be something else. And the other difference is that when people overeat, they generally don't have shame. They generally are like, oh, I ate too much of that. I ate too much pie. I'll just cut down tomorrow. But when people binge, there's a lot of shame. It's like, oh, I feel so bad about myself because I ate that.
Mm. That makes sense. So overeating is more physical hunger versus the binge eating, which is more like emotional hunger, eating out of emotion.
Emotional hunger, it could also be other things. It could be, so it's always psychological, which doesn't necessarily mean only emotional. Like you can eat to the point, people eat sometimes to the point where they're in physical pain. And they just can't stop, and they're in so much pain, and that is converting emotional pain to physical pain. Mm. So in a way, it's emotional, but kind of tangentially. So it's like it's always something psychological about your internal world, your head and your heart, whereas overeating is just about having too much because of you know, either your eyes, either, what is that expression? Your eyes are bigger than your head. No, that's when you don't eat it. Just because it just means you just have too much because you're too hungry and you don't reach fullness. Mm. You don't recognize when you're full, or there's something kind of cultural going on. You're having a celebration. Right. So that's basically the difference.
So last night I went to a new restaurant with like five girlfriends, and I was so excited to like try this place. It was really good Greek food. And I kind of had an idea going into it that like I wanted to try everything, and we were going to drink wine and like, you know, eat a lot. And I wasn't even that hungry. And I kind of felt bad about like kind of overeating during the day. And so I ended up like eating so much. And then, like, I got home and I felt, like, so bad about it. Like, why did I eat so much? Like, it was delicious. It was great. But I just felt, like, physical pain.
Right.
And so I guess, is that both? Is that overeating and binge eating? Because I felt, like, guilty about the day.
Well,
And I wasn't even hungry.
I think there's something about deprivation that's there too, because one of the things you said was you knew it was going to be super yummy and you were going to give yourself permission to have it. And if you're constantly eating things that you don't necessarily like, but they're healthy, or the new word is clean, if you're eating clean, I don't know if this pertains to you, Nicole, but I'm wondering if it does, and it's not really all that delicious. When you have a chance to have something delicious, you're going to want a lot of it.
Right.
So
that makes total sense.
Yeah, so I'm guessing that you are not having enough yummy meals. Have more things that you think are delicious, and then it won't be so special to go out and go to a super good Greek restaurant, which is very tasty.
Got it. That's fantastic advice. Thank you. I'm going to try that.
You're so welcome. Yes, let me know how it goes.
And okay.
What restaurant Thank is it, by so the way?
Oh,
it sounds
it's
good.
Called Luca. It's in Beverly Hills on Cannon, and it's so good. It's new. It's next to Rite Aid on Cannon between Brighton Way and Dayton. I thought Avra was good, but I tried this place last night, and it's half as expensive and the food is twice as good. So I highly recommend anyone in the area to try it. It was really, really, really good.
Well, half as expensive and twice as good sounds like the perfect place. I'm gonna check it out. Luca. All right.
Yeah.
And okay, so eat peanut butter and have yummy food. You will actually eat less.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thank
Nicole.
You so much.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, bye, Dr. Nina.
Bye. Yeah, if you're overeating or binging, there is always a reason. There's always a reason. And the key is to finding that reason, recognizing, well, what's going on? Because if you're turning to food, you're turning away from something else, or you're resolving some problem, or you're making up for something. There's always, always, always a reason. So, I got an email from Kevin in Atlanta. He writes, Dr. Nina, I listen to your show and you talk a lot about self-esteem. Oh, if anyone else wants to join me today, I think I forgot to give you the number. Nicole calls every week, so she has the number. The number is 818-602-4929. 818-602-4929. Give me a call. All right, Kevin in Atlanta writes, Dr. Nina, I listen to your show, and you talk a lot about self-esteem. As I understand it, raising self-esteem is one of the most important things we can do for ourselves. That makes sense to me as a concept, but how does it work in the real world? My question is, how can I find my way to more self-esteem when I feel so bad about myself right now? So, Kevin, great question. And by the way, I define self-esteem as confidence in your own worth and your own abilities. Basically, confidence in your own worth, not abilities, because that's more about what you're doing, but just a sense of confidence about yourself. But so a lot of people have different definitions for self-esteem. That's mine. So I came across this article that I found really interesting. Kevin, I think you'll find it interesting, and anyone else listening, I hope you will find it interesting as well. It's from selfcompassion.org, and it's called Why We Should Stop Chasing Self-Esteem and Start Developing Self-Compassion. Now, this post was written by Dr. Kristen Neff. She's an expert in self-compassion and has written books about the subject. And she says, it has almost become a truism in our culture that we need to have high self-esteem in order to be happy and healthy. Psychologists have conducted thousands of studies touting the benefits of self-esteem. Teachers are encouraged to give all their students gold stars so that each one can feel proud and special. We are told to think positively about ourselves at all costs, like with positive affirmations. You know, what's that old saying? I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. But she says, as research is now starting to demonstrate, the need to continually elevate ourselves positively comes at a high price. The main problem is that having high self-esteem requires feeling special and above average. Now, again, this is her definition. I would say having high self-esteem does not necessarily mean you're comparing yourself to others, but she's saying that it is. To be called average, she says, is considered an insult in our culture. How did you like my performance last night? Oh, it was average. Ouch! Of course, it's logically impossible for every human being on the planet to be above average at the same time. So we develop what is known as a self-enhancement bias. A self-enhancement bias, which refers to the tendency to think of ourselves as superior to others on a variety of dimensions. Again, I gotta say that I can't quite sign off on this idea, this is me, not her, now talking, that self-esteem means always comparing yourself to others. I think the true self-esteem is feeling good about yourself no matter what anyone else is doing around you. But again, back to the topic, because it's food for thought, right? It's kind of interesting. So she says that studies have shown that most people feel they're friendlier, more popular, funnier, nicer, more trustworthy, wiser, and more intelligent than others. What are these studies? Because that has not been my experience. But anyway, ironically, most people also think they're above average in the ability to view themselves objectively. The result of wearing these rose-colored glasses isn't so pretty, says Dr. Neff. The need to feel superior, again, I think it's different from self-esteem, but okay. The need to feel superior results in a process of social comparison in which we continually try to puff ourselves up and put others down. Just think of the film Mean Girls, and you'll understand what I am talking about. She says bullies generally have high self-esteem, since picking on people weaker than themselves is an easy way to boost image. Again, sorry, Dr. Neff, I disagree. I think bullies have low self-esteem and they pick on other people to make themselves feel better. She says, it may not come as a surprise that 65% of today's students score higher in narcissism than previous generations. And their average self-esteem levels rose by an even greater margin over the same period between, you know, whatever this period of time that they were comparing narcissism levels. She says that at the same time we try to see ourselves as better than others, and here's the important part of the article, we also tend to criticize ourselves when we don't meet our high standards. As soon as our feelings of superiority slip, as they inevitably will, our sense of worthiness takes a nosedive. Okay. She says we swing wildly between overly inflated and overly deflated self-esteem, an emotional roller coaster ride whose end result is often insecurity, anxiety, and depression. So what's the alternative? How do we feel good about ourselves without needing to feel better than others and therefore falling into that self-loathing trap? So one answer, says she, is to develop self-compassion. And I would say that, Kevin, and to all of you, that how do we feel good about ourselves? Forget the piece about feeling better than others. you know, how we feel good about ourselves is to be compassionate towards ourselves. It doesn't have to mean that you feel superior to others. I can't stress that point enough, apparently. So self-compassion involves being kind to ourselves when life goes awry or when we notice something about ourselves we don't like, rather than being cold and harshly self-critical. Self-compassion recognizes that the human condition is imperfect. So we feel connected to others when we fail or when we suffer, rather than feeling separate or isolated. Self-compassion also involves mindfulness, the recognition and non-judgmental acceptance of painful emotions as they arise in the present moment, rather than suppressing our pain or making it seem as if we're fine or thinking that it shouldn't bother us. We see ourselves and our situation really clearly, with clarity and compassion. Hold that thought. I have another caller. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Nina. This is Larry. How are you this Wednesday?
Hello, Larry from Burbank. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, you know, I heard you talking about self-esteem, and it brought to mind, and maybe I'm old school and it's kind of a slippery slope, but we seem to be in a culture of participation trophies, where if somebody, a little kid, whatever, does something just average, they're heaped with praise and awards and plaques just for showing up. But I risk sounding like someone who is not behind building up a child and getting the child to develop his or her own self-esteem through doing things that are average, but as well as good. It just seems to sort of dumb down the whole bar.
I agree. And I think that when you... Actually, the article that I was just reading from Dr. Kristen Neff, she mentions giving gold stars to all kids, no matter what their performance is. How people develop self-esteem is not by constantly being praised. Praise is good, but when they lose, self-esteem is developed when you can bear the pain of losing. And you come to terms with, okay, you know what, my team lost, or I didn't get an A. What am I going to learn from this? How can I do better next time? Rather than being rewarded for whether you win or lose, that doesn't teach any kind of developmental capacity to bear something painful. And self-esteem is.
Go ahead, sorry.
A self-esteem is being able to feel good about yourself without having to constantly win or be the best or achieve.
Mm-hmm. The flip side of that is I work at the local library, and occasionally we'll get some young folks, middle school, even high school, who act out, shout, carry on, have no respect for authority. And I hate to use that word. Have no respect for people who want them to do what's right in the library.
Authority.
And often their parents come back and defend them, thereby, you know, they know they're protected, they know that the kids aren't going to be punished versus appropriate punishment for doing something wrong. They're the same parents who hand out showing up trophies, and they're teaching their kids to be weak, and I think they have to expect the world to be their oyster, and they're going to get a rude awakening when they get out there after high school and college.
Yes, they are not teaching something called accountability and responsibility,
right,
and respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Shifting gears, actually, I have a question about this gray area between letting things go and standing up for myself. A week ago, my brother sent me an email that was kind of hurtful, and without going into detail, it was kind of a surprise. And I haven't answered him, and I'm okay with his point of view. My low self-esteem person wants to get back at him, you know, and send a nasty email and blah, 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 cut ties and, you know, and all of that. And I didn't. He was on the phone with my mom, And I just spoke and didn't speak at all about the subject at hand and just said, you know, how's everything, blah, blah, blah. And I feel good about that. Letting it go, knowing he's got his point of view, et cetera. The other side of the same coin, problems at work where the managers are not accountable. And I keep, the universe keeps showing me signs of stand up to bullies. Don't let them get away with it, blah, blah, blah. I'm still going through my union to fight them. I think it would be easier to let it go, but just stand up to bullies. Where do you draw the line? What's the gray area? I'm sure it has to vary case by case, but I'm just wondering if you have any general thoughts about that.
Well, my thought is that the line, there is no objective line. It's whether your sense of integrity can bear stepping back, or whether if by stepping back and context is everything in this, right? Standing up against a bullying boss has different implications than standing up against, you know, a bullying kid in the library. But I would say that in this situation, you've got your union involved. What's at stake if you continue, and what's at stake if you step back?
Well, you know, this may be my ego answering the question, but to a large extent, maybe to an extreme extent, standing up to a bully is more important than this particular job. And I know that without going into details, I'm untouchable anyway, the way things had transpired with the city attorney, et cetera. And I would rather, you know, look at myself in the mirror 20 years from now and say, you know what, that one time, that first time in my life, I stood up, I did what I could, then I let it go. I'm kind of answering my own question.
Yes, and you're talking about your personal integrity and what is just unbearable when it's unbearable to step down because you feel like you've sacrificed too much, then you keep going.
Right, right. Okay, good. That helps, you know, I guess yabbering about it on the air or yabbering about it in general, talking about it, I should say.
Yes, thank you for that. I was just about to say yabbering? That sounds slightly pejorative, Larry.
Yeah, yeah, I was kicking
sharing?
Myself in the head. Hashtag bad habit. talking about it and sharing it is just helps to see that from a more objective standpoint. I'm going to see this through as much as I can. And then, you know, one final thought, and then we've got to get back to my little laptop. The guy who said that bullies have high self-esteem needs to stop dropping acid.
Dr. Kristen Neff. Yes. I know.
Yeah.
Bullies. Can we take a look at our fearless leader, please?
I actually heard, and this is, well, I'll say it, you know what, free speech, a very well-known writer came up with a name for our fearless leader, and that is the America's Cheese Whiz Caligula, that says it all. So.
That does say it all, and as of now, we still do have free speech, thankfully, but I think America's Cheese Whiz Caligula encapsulates exactly what the problem is. Yes. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure. And thank you for all your help.
You're very welcome. Call me and let me know how it goes.
I shall do that. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah. So self-esteem is not being grandiose, and it's not comparing yourself to other people, and it's not being better than other people. That seems to be the notion that the article started on. But the most important part of it was what I was getting to later, which was about self-compassion, which she says, self-compassion doesn't demand that we evaluate ourselves positively or that we see ourselves as better than others. Rather, the positive emotions of self-compassion kick in exactly when self-esteem falls down, when we don't meet our expectations, or when we fail in some way. That means that the intrinsic self-worth inherent in self-compassion is highly stable. You're going to feel good about yourself when you're, no matter what's going on, no matter whether you're succeeding or failing. Self-compassion is consistently available to provide us with care in times of need. And by the way, her research has shown that self-compassion offers the same benefits of high self-esteem, again, as defined by her, such as less anxiety, less depression, and more happiness. So the more self-compassionately you can relate to yourself, is that a word? Self-compassionately? It is now. I just said it with conviction, so that makes it a word in my book. I must have a high self-esteem. All right, enough about that. Self-compassion is not associated with any of the downsides of self-esteem, again, as she describes it, such as narcissism, social comparison, or defensiveness. So she says, instead of endlessly chasing self-esteem as if it were the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, Dr. Neff argues that we should encourage the development of self-compassion. That way, whether we're on top of the world or at the bottom of the heap, we can embrace ourselves with a sense of kindness, connectedness, and emotional balance. We can provide the emotional safety needed to see ourselves clearly and make whatever changes are necessary to address our suffering. We can learn to feel good about ourselves, not because we're special and above average, but because we're human beings intrinsically worthy of respect. And that's from an article. You can find it on selfcompassion.org. Again, food for thought, and I especially like the last part about self-compassion as what you should be aiming for, Kevin and everyone, rather than self-esteem. You know, the upshot is that being kind to yourself and connected to others, treating yourself and others with compassion, brings about inner peace. And now I have another caller. Hi, caller, you're on with Dr. Nina. Welcome.
Hi, it's Brian from Chicago. How are you?
Hi, Brian from Chicago. Good to hear from you.
Thanks. So my question is, when it comes to emotional eating, what do you think is the worst or most triggering emotion?
Wow, that's a really thought-provoking question. I mean, I have two answers. One, and they may seem to disagree with each other, but one of them is that everybody is different. So everyone's worst emotion is triggered by something different. You know, some people may turn to food because they're sad, others because they're mad, or anything in between. So on the one hand, there's a lot of individuality in terms of what is the worst emotion, that the most triggering emotion. However, that said, I think that shame is the most awful feeling that people can have, or even more than helplessness. Often we even feel shame about feeling helpless. And shame is the experience of feeling as if there is something wrong with you, that there's something intrinsically just not right, not lovable, not good enough about you. And that's unbearable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes total sense. I was just curious because there are so many triggers kind of in the world right now. I was just wondering your opinion as to what might be one of the, you know, the really common and severe ones.
Yeah, and often shame is tied to different types, different feelings. For example, shame can be associated with, let's talk about what's going on in the world, in our world, in the United States. I know people are listening in other countries, but you're probably aware of what's going on in our country. And the sense of powerlessness can make us feel really bad, not just about the situation, but about ourselves, just not being able to make a difference in our world. Being helpless is so painful and awful that it can even be converted to shame.
Right. That makes total sense. And I certainly know a lot of people who are experiencing that. Thank you so much. That's kind of what I was wondering.
Okay. Well, Brian, thank you as always for calling with good questions that, you know, everyone who calls, when what you're asking, believe me, someone else is wondering. So any question is so helpful just to you and to everyone else who's listening. So thank you for calling and asking such a great question.
Always. I will call again for sure.
Okay. Talk to you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, shame. Oof. Shame versus guilt. Guilt is feeling bad about something that you did or didn't do. Shame is a feeling bad about who you are, and it's just the worst. It's unbearable. And when something's unbearable, you gotta get away. Get away from it. And one way to get away is dive into food. Because when you're eating, you get in that food zone, that eating zone of not really feeling anything or thinking anything temporarily. But of course, then you feel shame for doing that. So it's a vicious and horrible cycle. So I often get resistance when I talk to people about self-compassion. So I want to share with you some of the things. How much time do we have? Oh, we have time. I want to share some of the things that people say. One of the things that I hear is self-compassion is self-indulgent, right? So there is a difference, a huge, huge difference between self-indulgence and self-compassion. The only thing they have in common is the word self comes first. Self-compassion involves your health and well-being. Self-indulgent is about being, well, it's about giving yourself whatever the heck you want, without your thoughts of well-being or what anyone else wants, right? Self-indulgence is just, I want that, I'll have that. Self-compassion is about becoming aware of and sitting with and working through your pain, which is hard to do. Because again, getting back to what Larry said, we're raising a generation of kids who never have to experience the pain of losing or the pain of not doing as well as they you know, might otherwise have done because they're getting gold stars or trophies for just showing up. So we're not learning how to metabolize our pain. And self-indulgence is just a distraction and a denial of pain. Another common belief and things that this is what I hear a lot is that self-criticism, which is sort of the opposite of self-compassion, self-criticism is motivational. It's like, if I don't criticize myself, I won't get anything done. Self-criticism keeps me in line. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. So this is a quote from, again, the expert on self-compassion, Dr. Kristen Neff, who I like what she said is here. She says, while the motivational power of self-criticism comes from fear, or fear of punishment or self-punishment, the motivational power of self-compassion comes from the desire to be healthy and to reduce suffering. That's kind of lovely. So that's something to think about. Again, related, another pushback that people have said is, it's selfish for me to be compassionate towards myself. Well, many people, many women in particular, are taught to put others ahead of themselves. And self-compassion can seem like the opposite of what you should be doing, right? Oh, you should be taking care of other people and making them happy, not taking care of yourself or not being compassionate towards yourself. But how will beating yourself up help you be kinder to others? The source of our compassion will only be more authentic when we're able to show compassion to ourselves first. The better able you are to be compassionate to yourself, the better ability you will have to be compassionate to others. Here's another one. Self-compassion is for wimps. I just need to put on my big girl panties and stop whining. I need to man up. I need to butch up. I need to cowboy up. I need to pull myself up by the bootstraps. Yeah, that's a common refrain. Our society tends to reward toughing things out, right? Way more than it does being kind to and nurturing to ourselves. But the truth is that the strongest people are the ones who can have the courage to say, no, I'm not going to be tough. It's not weak to be nurturing to myself. It's human. It's not weak. We don't feel weak if we're nurturing to others, right? We don't feel like, oh, we're so weak when we're nice to our friends. We feel like we're good friends. This is how it's supposed to be. But somehow when we're nice to ourselves, bleh, then we feel weak and bad. No. Strength is the ability to withstand painful, difficult, upsetting emotions, and self-compassion is the recognition that we're going through something tough and that we need to be there for ourselves. Remember, there is a difference between being selfish, being selfless, and self-care. So selfish is, I don't care about anybody else. I just want to do what I want to do. Right? I want that, so I'm going to have it. Who cares how it affects anyone else? That's selfish. Selfless is the opposite, and it's just as bad. It's bad because it hurts you. Selfless is, I don't care about myself. I sacrifice myself. I have no needs. I have no wants. I'm just going to take care of you. And then what happens? Any resentment you might have ends up sort of, you know, bubbles up, and you got to keep it at bay. So you end up stuffing it, maybe literally and figuratively, and then you get mad at yourself for eating rather than recognizing that you have a feeling about the fact that you've sacrificed yourself for others and you're not giving yourself anything. Or you give everything to everyone else, and the only thing you can take in literally is food. Self-care is balance. Self-care is the ability to say, you know, I have certain needs, you have certain needs. Given this situation, I'm going to make a decision to maybe I'll take care of myself in this case and not you. Or another time, maybe I'll take care of you and not myself. But to have balance, and maybe there's no one else there and you're just nurturing yourself and being kind to yourself. So self-care is about balance. So here are some ideas on how to create compassion for yourself. The first one is not going to be any surprise to you. It's about being kind to yourself, being your own best friend. Remember, if you wouldn't say it to a friend or someone you love or a child, do not say it to yourself. If your friend calls you up and says, oh, I had such a terrible day at work, and last night I just couldn't stop eating ice cream. I ate like half a gallon of ice cream. I am disgusted with myself. I hate myself. Oh, I feel terrible. You're not going to say to your friend, you are disgusting. You should feel terrible. That's gross. What's your problem? Right? Which may be the things that you say to yourself. You're going to say to your friend, don't be so hard on yourself. You were eating it for a reason. How can I help? Let's meet for coffee or something. You know, it's not the end of the world. You know, eating ice cream means that you need comfort. So let's talk about that. So that's how to be with yourself. That's being a friend to yourself, a good friend. And that's self-compassion. Treat yourself as you would treat a friend who is suffering. Another thing to do is embrace your common humanity. Many times when we criticize or judge ourselves, we feel very isolated. It seems like you're the only person in the world who ate that ice cream or binged on whatever or is struggling or doesn't have a spouse or a kid or you're not where you should be. Or it can feel like you're you're the only one who's going through that, and everyone else seems like they're doing okay. But the reality is, we are all imperfect. We all suffer. We all go through things. And we're all connected by our shared humanity, including the idea that we suffer sometimes, that we don't get what we want, that we feel bad. And so one of the wonderful outcomes of self-compassion is our enhanced sense of belonging, the idea that we're all in this together. When you feel like you're a freak, as many people have told me, I'm a freak. Nobody else in the world is possibly doing this. You know, no one else is eating, you know, dried oatmeal and binging on it, or whatever it is that people think is just so weird and makes them unique in a bad way. No, someone else can relate. Someone else is doing exactly that. We are all bound by our humanity and our suffering, as well as our joyful moments and everything in between. So, you know, the next time you look in a mirror and you don't like what you see, remember that you are part of a tribe of people who are all going through what it takes to be human in this world. You know, flawed, wonderful, wounded, miraculous, and the totality of the human experience. You're not alone. Another way to develop self-compassion is to be mindful. So how do you know you're suffering if you're repressing that pain, rationalizing it, problem-solving it away? You know, you have to allow the awareness of whatever is painful or upsetting to enter in. The only way to get rid of feelings, after all, is to feel them, right? That sounds so counterintuitive. The only way to heal is to feel. You've got to get it out. Otherwise, it just stays in you and it festers and it gets worse and more horrible. So you've got to be aware of the pain that you are in. Notice that it is happening. Do not have a judgment on it. Do not say, well, I wouldn't be in this predicament if I were this or that. You just say, this is hurtful right now. This is painful right now. And you deal with it with compassion and kindness. You don't say, and don't catastrophize. This is how it's always going to be. It's hopeless. This means something about me. No. A feeling is just a reaction to a situation. It is not a character flaw, and it doesn't mean anything about the future. So self-compassion is about being with your pain in kind of a kind way. It's not just about making that pain disappear. It's about saying, okay, this is what I feel. There's a reason I feel it. And then you do the, you know, I'm not always going to feel it. You reassure yourself. But right now, this is painful. We will always have pain in our lives. I mean, that's just the human fact, not to be a downer, but just realistically, we will always have pain. But there is a difference between pain and suffering. Pain hurts. Suffering, and pain is temporary. Suffering is pain plus resistance. The more you resist what's hurting you, the more you try to deny it, make it go away, drop it, positive talk it away, all the things you may be doing to get rid of it, the more suffering you will experience. Suffering lasts. Pain doesn't. There's a Buddhist saying that says, when you get hurt, say, by an arrow, that results in pain. But there is a second arrow, which is your reaction to the arrow. The getting angry, the planning of revenge, the having bad ideas about yourself, the shame as a result of the first arrow, that is beyond the pain, that is suffering. And so remember, pain is an experience we have, we all have. Suffering is how we relate to this experience. And I'm going to talk more about that next week, because how we relate to pain often has to do with you know, what goes on with food. So when we change the way we relate to our pain, our suffering, to what may seem unbearable, everything with food will also change. So thank you for joining me today here on the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am so glad to spend this hour with you. If you'd like more food for thought and inspiration, check out my website, Dr. Nina Inc. That's drninainc.com. And follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Dr. Nina Inc. See you next week.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.